The death of King Rudolf III of Burgundy in early September 1032 opened the way for a long-prepared political transition. Years earlier, an agreement had been made between the Burgundian king and the German emperor that recognized imperial authority over Burgundy after Rudolf's death. This arrangement effectively placed the emperor, Conrad II, in a position of superior authority even before the Burgundian throne became vacant. Rudolf had demonstrated his intention clearly by sending royal insignia, including the crown, to Conrad through a trusted noble, thereby identifying the Salian ruler as his successor. Conrad's claim to Burgundy was therefore based on legal agreement and feudal recognition, making it stronger than that of Count Odo II of Blois. Odo relied mainly on family ties to justify his ambitions. Yet, he was no minor rival. His vast territory stretched across important regions of France, and his influence rivaled that of the French monarchy itself. His lands extended from the imperial frontier to the Loire River and beyond, creating a powerful territorial bloc. Only the French Duchy of Burgundy stood between his holdings and the Burgundian kingdom, and political alliances within France made it easier for him to move toward the region. At the time of Rudolf's death, Conrad was occupied with military matters along the Slavic frontier. Once he learned of the king's passing, he ended his campaign and began moving west. The journey required time, yet by December 1032, he had already reached central Germany, and soon after celebrated Christmas in Strasbourg with his wife Gisela and his son Henry. Despite the speed of his response, Odo had already acted. He moved swiftly through Burgundy, securing strongholds and gaining recognition in several regions, especially in Provence. However, he faced resistance from areas loyal to the Dowager Queen Irmgard, who still commanded influence in parts of the kingdom. Irmgard played a decisive role in shaping events after her husband's death. She likely sought support from Conrad while Odo attempted to secure his own position through force and negotiation. In the city of Vienne, a major centre of authority in Lower Burgundy, the Archbishop agreed to support Odo only under specific conditions, including a formal election and coronation. The situation revealed that the struggle for Burgundy was not simply a military conflict, but a contest for legitimacy, recognition, and symbolic authority. In early 1033, Conrad entered Burgundy itself, travelling through important religious and political centres. His arrival at the monastery of Payerne marked a turning point. This monastery was closely connected to Burgundian royalty and to the wider reform movement centred at Cluny, and it carried both political and spiritual significance. There, an assembly of nobles formally elected and crowned Conrad as ruler of Burgundy on a major religious feast day. The ceremony emphasized sacred authority and reinforced the image of imperial rule as divinely sanctioned. The coronation carried unusual features. Contemporary accounts describe Conrad as acting for the king, which may suggest that he also represented his son Henry in the ceremony. This interpretation implies a division of authority, with Conrad exercising broader imperial sovereignty, while Henry assumed more direct territorial control. Whatever the precise meaning, the event provided a legal foundation for imperial rule in Burgundy and weakened Odo's position. Following the coronation, Conrad attempted to secure the region by capturing strategic fortifications held by his rival. Yet harsh winter conditions halted military operations. Extreme cold devastated the imperial army, forcing the emperor to withdraw to safer territory. Despite this setback, important Burgundian nobles crossed the Alpine passes in severe weather to declare their loyalty to Conrad and his son. Their actions revealed that political allegiance was shifting steadily toward the emperor. Soon afterward, Conrad appeared far to the north, celebrating Easter in the Rhineland. Rather than continuing direct military campaigns in Burgundy, he turned to diplomacy. Odo had extended the conflict into neighbouring territories, attacking regions connected to the empire. Conrad responded by negotiating with the King of France. These talks produced a marriage alliance between the two ruling families and secured French military support. The agreement demonstrated that the Burgundian conflict was part of a wider European power struggle, involving both the empire and the French crown. Diplomatic rituals played an important role in such negotiations. Meetings between rulers followed established ceremonial traditions, including the exchange of envoys, gifts, and symbolic gestures of peace. These encounters emphasized honor, status, and mutual recognition. Even the exchange of exotic animals and precious objects formed part of the political language of the time, reflecting wealth and prestige while preserving the balance of dignity between rulers. With French support secured, Conrad launched a campaign against Odo's territories in 1033. Imperial forces devastated regions under the Count's control while the French king simultaneously attacked Odo's strongholds. Faced with overwhelming pressure, Odo sought mediation and eventually submitted to the emperor. He promised to abandon his claims in Burgundy and compensate for damages caused during the conflict. Although this settlement temporarily ended hostilities, tensions persisted. Odo's failure stemmed partly from strategic miscalculations. Earlier political choices had weakened his position, and the death or decline of potential allies left him increasingly isolated. Meanwhile, divisions within the French royal family further complicated the political landscape. Rivalries between the French king and his relatives reshaped alliances, ultimately strengthening cooperation between France and the empire. The imperial claim to Burgundy was further reinforced by military and diplomatic measures in the following years. The emperor reorganized key frontier regions and secured support from powerful nobles. By 1034, a coordinated campaign involving German and Italian forces moved into Burgundy from multiple directions. Strongholds fell, one after another, and former supporters of Odo shifted their allegiance to Conrad. By the summer of that year, the emperor entered Geneva in triumph, receiving the submission of regional leaders and establishing effective control over the kingdom. Although Burgundy had been secured, Conrad did not govern it directly with great intensity. His involvement in its internal affairs remained limited, and imperial authority functioned largely through local elites and political arrangements rather than continuous intervention. Even conflicts among regional leaders were often resolved without direct imperial action. The struggle for Burgundy did not end entirely with Conrad's victory. Later attempts were made to challenge imperial authority, and political unrest continued in surrounding regions. Yet the decisive defeat and death of Odo in 1037 eliminated the most serious threat to Salian control. From that point onward, the Burgundian kingdom became part of the imperial sphere, serving as a buffer between France and Italy and securing strategic Alpine routes. Conrad's rule in Burgundy, however, remained more symbolic than administrative. His authority was strongest in areas closest to the empire's core territories, particularly regions corresponding to modern Western Switzerland. In much of the kingdom, local powers retained considerable independence. The emperor's success lay less in direct governance than in securing recognition of imperial supremacy. The broader question of Conrad's relationship with the church has long been debated. Earlier, historians portrayed him as a ruler driven primarily by secular concerns, someone who valued political power above religious ideals. Such interpretations described him as indifferent to spiritual matters and suggested that his policies weakened ecclesiastical independence. Later, scholarship offered a different perspective, emphasizing that rulers of his time operated within a religious framework that shaped their authority and responsibilities. Rather than standing outside the church, the emperor was seen as part of its structure and traditions. Understanding this relationship requires examining the political and institutional system that linked monarchy and church. During this period, rulers appointed bishops and abbots, granting them lands, privileges, and authority in return for administrative and military support. This arrangement, often described as the imperial church system, created a network of loyal officials who combined religious and political roles. Although it sometimes conflicted with church law, it functioned as a practical solution to the challenges of governing a vast and diverse empire. Conrad largely maintained this established system without introducing major changes. He relied on capable church leaders who supported his policies and judged them according to their usefulness and loyalty rather than their origins. Many high ecclesiastical offices were filled by members of the aristocracy. Yet the emperor also supported individuals of more modest background when they proved effective. His approach emphasized stability and continuity rather than innovation. The structure of the German church during Conrad's reign included several major archbishoprics, each overseeing multiple dioceses. These ecclesiastical centers formed an essential part of imperial administration, providing economic resources, military support, and political influence. The emperor maintained close relationships with key bishoprics located along strategic routes, especially those connecting the empire with Italy or guarding important frontiers. Through these networks, religious authority and political power remained closely intertwined. In practice, Conrad's policy toward the church reflected pragmatic concerns. He sought cooperation from church leaders who could strengthen imperial control and maintain order within their regions. Questions of reform, doctrine, or spiritual life were often left to advisors and clerical experts, while the emperor focused on the political stability of his realm. This approach ensured that the existing balance between secular authority and religious institutions remained largely intact. Mainz did not become Germany's leading church center overnight. Its rise began in the early medieval period when determined churchmen worked to lift the city above its rivals. Over time, the Archbishop of Mainz came to be treated as the senior metropolitan in the German lands, a figure whose status carried weight far beyond his own diocese. By the 9th century, court practice reinforced this position. The royal chancery, the paperwork engine of government, was increasingly placed under the supervision of the court's chief chaplain, and before long that supervisory role became closely tied to the Archbishop of Mainz. From then on, the German king's official documents, seals, and administrative routines tended to flow through a structure in which Mainz stood at the top. As centuries passed, these court roles became part of a powerful tradition. The Archbishop of Mainz was commonly associated with the highest ecclesiastical office at court, supervising the chapel attached to the ruler's household and, by extension, the men trained within it. That court chapel mattered because it functioned as a recruiting ground for future bishops and senior clerics. Many of the most important church appointments in the empire did not begin in a monastery or a distant cathedral school, but in the day-to-day world of the ruler's entourage, where ambitious clerics learned politics, administration, ceremony, and loyalty. Holding honorary court titles could therefore translate into real influence. A determined archbishop with connections could turn these positions into a seat in the ruler's inner circle. This arrangement was not automatic or unbreakable. Kings sometimes resisted it, either because they distrusted the primate of Mainz, or because they wanted to pull the center of gravity elsewhere. Separate administrative needs also complicated the picture. Italy, for example, developed its own high-ranking chancellery leadership within the empire's wider structure. That Italian administration could become a political fault line, especially when a senior official chose to support a rival claimant rather than the reigning king. When that happened, the response was often simple. The ruler reassigned offices to a trusted ally, tightening control through personnel rather than theory. When Conrad II came to power, he operated within this inherited system and used it in a practical way. He removed one important official from the Italian administrative leadership and restored the post to the Archbishop of Mainz, who had played a key role in securing Conrad's election. In the political world of the early 11th century, such moves were not merely gestures of gratitude. They were part of the machinery of rule, because court offices gave access to information, influence over appointments, and visibility at the highest ceremonial moments of the reign. The archbishop who benefited most from this early phase was Aribo of Mainz. Aribo stood out among his peers as a highly capable and driven churchman. He had a reputation for intelligence, discipline, and deep interest in learned culture. He supported theological writing, commissioned works that dealt with the ordering of time and sacred history, and involved himself in the improvement of texts and education. His circle included figures connected to renowned monastic schools, and he took an active interest in how Latin should be written and refined. His career began in the orbit of Salzburg, and his influence extended into monastic foundations and building projects. He backed new religious houses, supported the creation of monasteries rooted in noble patronage, and pushed major reconstruction efforts in Mainz after fire damage had scarred the cathedral. In this sense, he was not just a political operator, he was also a builder and organizer with a strong sense of what a leading church center should look like. Yet the same qualities that made Aribo impressive also made him difficult. He was blunt to the point of harshness, certain of his own judgment and not easily persuaded once he formed an opinion. Contemporary observers described him as a man driven by work and authority, and that description captured both his strengths and his weaknesses. In the early years of Conrad II's reign, Aribo and the new ruler worked closely together. Their alliance formed before Conrad's succession was fully secure, and it appears to have been strengthened through court networks and high-level political friendships. A powerful widow empress and her relatives, competing influences inside the court. And the tension between different regional blocs all shaped the environment in which Conrad rose. Aribo positioned himself carefully within these currents and emerged as one of the key figures who helped stabilize the transition of power. The relationship between Aribo and Conrad, however, faced a dramatic early test. Soon after Conrad's election, Aribo refused to perform a joint coronation for the king's wife, Gisela. The exact motives are difficult to pin down, but the refusal was more than a personal slight. In a world where queenship, dynasty, and public ritual mattered, it created a gap that others could exploit. Conrad's own coronation in Mainz still went forward as a grand event that underlined Aribo's standing. After that, Aribo travelled with the ruler and remained highly visible during the king's progress through the realm. Official documents repeatedly placed him near the centre of power. His name appeared alongside that of other leading archbishops, including a close rival in Cologne, showing that the early Salian court operated as a stage where competing church princes performed influence in public view. Over time, Aribo's dominance became less secure. Disputes over ecclesiastical jurisdiction and privilege absorbed him, drawing him into long, grinding conflicts that distracted from court politics. This created openings for Conrad to act more independently, especially in key appointments. When a major bishopric became vacant, Conrad installed a successor without relying on Aribo's guidance, an unmistakable sign that the king could act on his own authority even against a powerful metropolitan. Aribo protested but ultimately adapted, performing the necessary consecrations and preserving outward cooperation. Aribo's role remained significant during Conrad's first preparations for Italy. He joined the royal party at key gathering points, where armies assembled and where the machinery of travel and governance was put in motion. Court documents from this period also reveal how decisions were framed publicly. Queens, archbishops, bishops, and other insiders appeared as supporters of grants and favours, and their presence signalled that a gift was not merely the king's whim, but part of a broader political and spiritual consensus. In some cases, the queen's role also served dynastic interests, reinforcing ties between a ruling family and the prayers offered by major churches. Italian politics then disrupted the rhythm of court life. Heat, resistance, and logistical difficulty delayed progress, and some leading figures returned north temporarily while the king's plans continued. Aribo later reappeared in the Italian arena for the imperial coronation and an important church council, then headed back into the German heartlands. There, he chaired major assemblies and encountered public setbacks. In one case, he suffered a humiliating loss in a dispute that had dragged on for years, and the emperor did not rescue him politically. Instead, Conrad allowed the archbishop's authority to be publicly checked. The king rebuked him openly for his behaviour toward a high-born abbess connected to the ruling dynasty. From that point onward, the relationship cooled. Yet Conrad still did not strip Aribo of his titles or formally remove him from his court roles. The tension remained real but contained, and Aribo kept his position until his death in 1031 while travelling south on pilgrimage. Aribo's successor could hardly have been more different. Bardo of Mainz was remembered as a monkish figure, known for simplicity, restraint, and a manner that seemed almost untouched by political ambition. He came from the monastic world and carried that identity into one of the most important archbishoprics in the kingdom. Some at court assumed this would make him easier to steer, and family influence played a role in his elevation, with the Empress supporting his advancement. Yet the appointment was not universally celebrated. Other candidates were considered, including one celebrated for learning and austere reform ideals. And the fact that such a figure was passed over suggests how strongly birth, court alliances, and internal rivalries shaped high appointments. The early weeks of Bardo's tenure revealed how brutal court judgment could be. During a major feast, he delivered a short, plain sermon that drew mockery from aristocratic listeners who expected polished rhetoric and intellectual display. The emperor's anger flared, and the empress became the target of blame for the choice. The next day, a far more impressive sermon by another bishop made the contrast sharper and deepened the embarrassment. Yet, Bardo did not fold. He spoke again and delivered a more complex and emotionally grounded address, anchored in scripture and shaped with unexpected skill. The episode hinted that he was not as shallow as some assumed. Even so, Bardo's position remained uneasy. His court influence faded quickly, and official documents from the following years show a striking decline in his visible role. Key court offices tied to Italy shifted away from Mainz, and there were signs that even the older ceremonial link between Mainz and the highest chapel offices could be delayed or weakened. Meanwhile, within Mainz itself, Bardo struggled with the harsh realities of lordship. Powerful advocates pressed legal claims. Local people suffered pressure and threats, and the archbishop proved unable to shield his dependents effectively. Some of his own men abandoned him and attached themselves directly to the emperor, a humiliating reversal that exposed how fragile ecclesiastical authority could be when it lacked political muscle. Yet Bardo was not simply a weak figure drifting through office. Under his leadership, the great rebuilding of Mainz's cathedral complex moved toward completion. A major consecration ceremony took place in the presence of the imperial family and a large gathering of bishops, an event designed to project unity, sacred prestige, and restored grandeur. Inside the cathedral community, Bardo promoted a disciplined common life among the clergy, pushing them toward a more structured and communal religious routine. His personal lifestyle remained close to monastic ideals, built around prayer and work rather than courtly display. In this sense, he represented a different model of archiepiscopal leadership, less a political strategist, more a spiritual organizer and institutional reformer. His policies, however, could create conflict. He supported the broader push to clarify the boundaries between monastic and secular clergy, a dispute with real economic consequences because of the tithes that parishes generated. Bardo backed the claim that monasteries in his province should remit a substantial share of tithe income to the metropolitan authority. This challenged older habits and provoked resistance. But it also shows that he was capable of firm governance when it aligned with his vision of church order. Seen from a distance, the choice of Bardo after Aribo makes political sense. A sharp, forceful, uncompromising archbishop had generated friction at court and in church disputes. Replacing him with a calmer, more inwardly religious figure reduced the chance of direct collision between the imperial household and the archiepiscopal court. At the same time, the broader reform movement of the age did not vanish from this story. Bardo's earlier monastic promotions had been linked to reform efforts, and other appointments around him continued to bring stricter observance into important monasteries. He was not the spokesman of the most famous reform leaders, but he fit into the same wider climate, discipline, renewal, and a desire to reshape religious life through institutions. The contrast becomes sharper when the focus shifts from Mainz to Cologne. Cologne's archbishop during these years, Pilgrim, functioned as a different type entirely, politically flexible, socially skilled, and adept at turning crises into advantages. He was related to Aribo and shared court connections, yet he played the game with more agility. When Aribo refused to crown Gisela, Pilgrim stepped in and performed the coronation elsewhere, creating a precedent that strengthened Cologne's position and expanded its ceremonial claims. Later, he crowned the young heir Henry III in Aachen, a move that established patterns later rulers would follow. Pilgrim also became deeply involved in Italian administration and was well suited to it, having experience as an Italian chancellor and even a military leader in southern Italy earlier in his career. When the opportunity arose, he secured a leading role in Italian chancery affairs and turned it into a long-lived precedent. Pilgrim's power also rested on local alliances and reform patronage. He worked closely with leading secular magnates in his region, supported major monastic foundations, encouraged reform-minded abbots, expanded important churches within the city, and strengthened the cultural life of the cathedral school. He may not have been a dazzling scholar, but he understood how to build institutions and how to harness piety, prestige, and personal networks. In almost every sense, he matched the classic image of a high imperial bishop, politically engaged, socially connected, active in building projects, and skilled at linking religious reform to elite expectations. His successor in Cologne, Hermann, continued this pattern with even greater dynastic weight. Born into one of the most powerful families connected to the imperial bloodline, surrounded by siblings who held high offices in church and royal politics, he represented the fusion of aristocratic power and ecclesiastical leadership at its peak. He stepped into Italian administration immediately, accompanied the emperor on campaign, and later oversaw the movement of Conrad's body through Cologne's religious foundations before burial at Speyer. His election was described as inspiring, widespread joy, a sign that the appointment satisfied both court politics and local expectation. Cologne, in other words, offered a counter-image to Mainz, a place where political skill, dynastic prestige and institutional strength reinforced each other rather than pulling apart. A similar but more complicated counter-example appeared in the north at Hamburg-Bremen. This province had an unusual history, shaped by missionary ambition and the struggle to operate beyond the empire's borders. Its leaders were tied not only to local politics, but to the larger project of Christian expansion into Scandinavia and neighboring pagan regions. That outward focus affected its internal position in Germany, including its relationship with Cologne and its ongoing conflicts with powerful regional dukes. Earlier, archbishops worked to keep cooperation alive between the church province and the local ruling family, and at times succeeded. One archbishop became a skilled mediator in major disputes, and even helped reconcile Conrad II with a great northern king, securing peace through diplomacy and personal relationships. In this northern world, court service mattered too. Men who had come through the royal chapel often gained an edge over equally competent rivals because they had access to the ruler and familiarity with court expectations. Yet, not every appointment followed that route. At one point, an archbishop was chosen largely through recommendation and local standing rather than court experience. These archbishops also acted forcefully, especially in asserting authority over distant missionary territories. Discipline could be harsh, and enforcement methods could look severe even by contemporary standards. Wealth and patronage played a role as well. Some archbishops used their personal resources to stabilize financially weak churches, a practice later critics would condemn, but which rulers valued for obvious reasons. Not every archbishop in Hamburg-Bremen succeeded. One short-lived appointment proved disastrous. The man chosen cooperated with local nobles, strengthened defences and treated the northern mission base as expendable, even hostile terrain. He spent little time in his see and preferred his old power base elsewhere. The result was neglect at the centre of the province's unique identity. His replacement restored energy to building programmes, especially in Hamburg, established stronger fortifications, and asserted independence in ways that intensified long-term rivalry with local ducal power. That shift had consequences later, but in the moment it demonstrated that Conrad II could find capable northern church leaders when he relied on candidates shaped by the court environment. Beyond these dramatic provinces, much of the empire's ecclesiastical frontier looked calmer. In Trier and Magdeburg, long-serving archbishops appointed under the previous ruler remained in office throughout Conrad's reign and beyond. They travelled, participated in major ceremonial events, and occasionally played roles in diplomacy. But their careers cannot be read simply as products of Conrad's policy, since they owed their position to earlier decisions. Salzburg, likewise, followed a quieter pattern. Its archbishops attended major imperial events and held significant authority within their province, sometimes acting with powers that mirrored those of Rome's representatives. They received royal favours and managed vast southeastern territories, yet they rarely appeared as dominant actors at the centre of imperial politics. This provincial focus may not reflect weakness so much as an informal division of labour. A ruler who spent much of his reign moving through the realm, responding to wars and succession crises, often needed dependable regional managers more than headline-making church princes. In the southeast, stability mattered. Managing relations with local magnates, keeping peace in a huge borderland region, and ensuring that religious and political order held. The archival traces from Salzburg suggest an administration preoccupied with property, rights, and institutional memory, commissioning records that mapped land dealings and donations in a way meant to secure the archbishop's place among predecessors and successors. That kind of document-driven governance lacks dramatic scenes. but it reveals the steady work that kept an early medieval church province functioning. In the German kingdom, the bishops of Strasbourg, Würzburg, and Augsburg stood out among the churches that answered to the Archbishop of Mainz. Their importance was not simply ceremonial. Each of these dioceses possessed real political and military weight, shaping both regional authority and imperial policy. Strasbourg, in particular, held remarkable responsibilities. Records from the late 10th century describe how its bishop was expected to supply a large contingent of heavily armed knights for imperial campaigns, a force matched only by the greatest archbishoprics of the realm and equaled among German sees only by Augsburg. This alone reveals how deeply military power and ecclesiastical authority were intertwined in the political order of the time. The life of Bishop Werner of Strasbourg illustrates the far-reaching influence of such figures. He died far from home while serving as an imperial envoy in the Byzantine world, a sign of how closely bishops could be involved in international diplomacy. His career extended across the reigns of several rulers, and he played an important advisory role at court. He accompanied the king to Rome for the imperial coronation and helped shape the handling of major church disputes. Earlier in his life, he had supported a different claimant during a contested royal succession, a choice that brought him into conflict with powerful regional authorities. Military force was even used against Strasbourg itself, yet the bishop's position ultimately prevailed, demonstrating the strength of episcopal authority when backed by royal power. Werner's successor, William, emerged from the same environment of court service and noble connections, yet his career unfolded very differently. Though closely linked to the ruling family and entrusted with important religious duties, he left little mark on the broader political stage. His tenure became notable mainly for an awkward controversy concerning the proper calculation of the liturgical calendar. When he attempted to celebrate a major religious season earlier than tradition allowed, the emperor and leading churchmen rejected the decision and established clear limits for its observance. The incident shows how closely rulers monitored religious practice, not only out of piety, but also from a concern for order and uniformity within the realm. Despite such missteps, William fulfilled his pastoral duties faithfully and devoted himself to the construction and organization of churches, reflecting the practical expectations placed upon bishops, even when they lacked political brilliance. Augsburg presented a different model of episcopal power. The city had grown wealthy through trade and economic privileges and served as an important gathering point for royal expeditions to Italy. Its bishop, Bruno, brother of an emperor, combined noble birth with administrative experience. His relationship with his royal sibling was often strained, yet he remained deeply involved in imperial affairs and became one of the new king's closest advisors. He was entrusted with the supervision of the heir to the throne and played a decisive role in major ecclesiastical assemblies. His influence extended to both political governance and religious policy, showing how members of the ruling dynasty could reinforce royal authority through episcopal office. After his death, however, the see passed to a successor about whom little is known, suggesting how quickly influence could fade when a strong personality was replaced by a less prominent figure. Another important center of power lay in Metz, where Bishop Dietrich, related to the imperial family through marriage, helped stabilize the realm during periods of uncertainty. He and his relatives worked to maintain peace during transitions of power and occasionally acted as mediators in conflicts involving foreign rulers and rebellious nobles. Known for his eloquence and learning, he enjoyed considerable respect among contemporaries. Even in old age, he continued to contribute to imperial campaigns by providing military support and participating in major assemblies. His long career reflects the steady partnership that could develop between the crown and loyal church leaders. The Bishopric of Worms offers a particularly vivid example of how ecclesiastical office could shape both personal and institutional advancement. The future emperor himself had once been educated under its bishop, forming a connection that endured throughout his life. When a new bishop was appointed, the king bestowed generous privileges and confirmed extensive property rights for the church. The Cathedral School of Worms became a centre of intellectual life, producing influential legal and theological works and fostering a strong communal spirit among its clergy. The environment encouraged education and administrative skill, allowing individuals of learning to rise within the church hierarchy. The cultural atmosphere of Worms also reveals the broader role of learning in ecclesiastical society. Scholars there compiled collections of church law that guided religious practice across Europe, while teachers cultivated a disciplined and educated clergy. Even women could participate in this intellectual world under certain conditions. Accounts describe how the sister of a bishop received advanced instruction in religious texts, administrative duties, and the complex calculations required for determining the dates of major festivals. Her later leadership of a religious community demonstrated how education could enable women of suitable background to assume positions of authority within ecclesiastical institutions. Within this setting, ambitious clerics sought advancement through both talent and connections. Cathedral canons cultivated relationships at court, exchanged favours, and secured positions through networks of patronage. Letters from the period reveal how information, influence, and even material gifts could be used to obtain appointments. Such practices, though rarely acknowledged openly, formed part of the social fabric of the church and shaped many careers. Some individuals rose from local service to become bishops in distant regions, carrying with them the educational traditions of their home institutions. Other bishoprics held special significance for the ruling family. The church at Eichstätt served as a place where trusted associates of the court could be settled in secure positions, while the city of Speyer became deeply connected with the imperial household itself. Its bishops were often chosen by the ruler and entrusted with major building projects and reforms. The intellectual life of Speyer flourished through strong cathedral schools and close ties with monastic learning. Educated clergy composed theological and literary works, and even women from noble backgrounds participated in scholarly activity, producing religious writings and contributing to the cultural life of the church. In Würzburg, a different intellectual atmosphere prevailed. Its clergy were cautious toward classical learning and emphasized strict religious orthodoxy, sometimes clashing with neighboring centers that valued broader scholarship. The bishops themselves generally avoided involvement in such disputes, focusing instead on maintaining stability within their diocese. One later bishop, closely related to the ruling dynasty, combined noble lineage with experience in royal administration and played an active role in imperial policy, particularly in matters concerning Italy. His reputation for diligence and moral integrity eventually led to veneration after his death. The bishopric of Hildesheim provides an example of religious reform carried out with determination and conviction. Its bishop, once a prominent monastic leader, sought to strengthen discipline, expand church building, and improve education. His firm character, however, sometimes made reconciliation with opponents difficult, revealing the tensions that could arise between personal conviction and political necessity. After his death, the see passed to a cleric connected to the royal household, illustrating once again how ecclesiastical appointments could serve both spiritual and political purposes. In Regensburg, the appointment of a royal relative as bishop shows another aspect of the system. The position offered status and security for members of the ruling family, even when the individual chosen possessed little aptitude for pastoral leadership. Contemporary accounts describe dissatisfaction among the local population, and later traditions portray the bishop's conduct in harsh terms. Such examples reveal that episcopal office could be shaped as much by dynastic considerations as by religious ideals. The Diocese of Paderborn, though comparatively small, produced one of the most energetic church leaders of the age. Its bishop, of noble origin and trained in royal service, revitalized the region through construction projects, educational reforms, and administrative organization. He established monasteries, improved parish structures, and raised academic standards within the cathedral school. Stories about his forceful personality circulated widely, depicting him as both a strict ruler and a capable administrator who demanded discipline, yet also supported the welfare of his subjects. His life demonstrates how a determined bishop could transform even a modest diocese into a centre of vitality. Elsewhere, the bishopric of Toul gained lasting importance through the career of a man who would later ascend to the papacy. Connected by family ties to the ruling house, he served first as a court cleric before accepting election to a local see rather than pursuing a more prestigious position. His leadership strengthened reform movements and reshaped the religious life of his diocese, preparing the ground for later changes within the wider church. In Constance, two brothers successively held the episcopal office, one a monk of noble birth, and the other a product of the royal chapel. Their careers illustrate the close interaction between monastic reform, court service, and episcopal authority. The elder bishop intervened boldly in political affairs, acting as guardian to a ducal heir and asserting episcopal authority over monastic privileges. His successor continued the intellectual traditions of cathedral education and promoted the study of church law within the diocese. Halberstadt likewise experienced dramatic leadership. One bishop, initially disgraced in monastic life, later championed reform and defended his rights against local nobles, even going into temporary exile. His successor, drawn from the royal chancery, became renowned for his sense of justice and personal courage. Accounts describe how he intervened to prevent the execution of men falsely accused, appealing directly to the emperor and securing their release. Such stories, shaped by later admiration, portray him as a model of righteous authority. The relationship between royal power and church authority in the medieval empire was never entirely peaceful. Kings and bishops were deeply connected in both theory and practice. Rulers influenced religious life, while bishops were closely involved in political affairs and often served in royal administration. During the reign of Conrad II, the most serious tensions between the emperor and members of the episcopate emerged mainly in the later years of his rule, especially in regions far from the German political center. Earlier in his reign, disputes with powerful bishops from the core of the empire were usually resolved quickly or carefully managed. His disagreements with leading church figures such as the archbishops of Cologne and Mainz never developed into open confrontation, even though they involved serious issues like royal marriages, church jurisdiction, and coronation ceremonies. Conrad preferred negotiation, patience, or quiet assertion of authority rather than dramatic conflict. One of the rare problems Conrad faced with church leaders concerned not political ambition but failure to carry out practical duties. Some bishops neglected the worldly responsibilities expected of their office, and this could provoke imperial displeasure. Yet the emperor generally avoided interfering in matters of church discipline or religious law unless external political interests were involved. When conflicts arose between bishops within the empire and foreign powers, however, he was willing to intervene. In other cases, he preferred compromise, allowing time to heal disagreements, rather than imposing direct judgment. A dispute involving a women's religious community in northern Germany reveals how imperial authority operated in practice. a previous bishop had appointed an abbess against the wishes of the nuns and without proper consultation. His successor attempted to remove her in order to restore harmony, but she appealed to the emperor, who ruled in her favour at a royal assembly. Despite this decision, the local bishop later forced her resignation. The episode did not create lasting hostility between emperor and bishop, but it showed that imperial rulings could be resisted when local leaders possessed sufficient influence. The emperor responded far more decisively when church leaders in the southeastern frontier regions pursued policies that threatened imperial control. In these borderlands, where royal authority was already fragile, political disobedience could not be tolerated. One important example was the case of the Bishop of Freising, a figure who had long enjoyed royal favour and held influential positions at court. He had served as royal chaplain, overseen the royal chancery, and later acted as guardian to the emperor's son. His loyalty had been rewarded with privileges and generous grants of property to his diocese. Despite this close relationship, the bishop eventually fell from favour when the emperor suspected him of supporting policies that weakened imperial influence in the southeastern territories and complicated relations with neighbouring powers. At a major royal assembly, the emperor publicly expelled him without even hearing his defence, apparently viewing his actions as a form of political betrayal. Yet this punishment proved temporary. Within a year, the bishop was restored to imperial favour and resumed his position at court. The details of his reconciliation remain unclear, but the episode demonstrates how royal authority could be severe yet flexible, allowing room for repentance and renewed loyalty. Another major conflict involved the powerful Patriarch of Aquileia in northern Italy, a church leader strongly supported by the emperor for many years. Conrad had defended his interests against rival cities, challenged papal decisions on his behalf, and promoted his claims at church councils. Despite this close partnership, a serious dispute arose during a confrontation involving the Archbishop of Milan, when the Milanese archbishop was arrested on charges of treason. He was placed under the patriarch's supervision, but soon escaped. The emperor blamed the patriarch for the failure, forcing him to withdraw from court. Reconciliation followed through a carefully staged public act of submission. The patriarch later met the emperor barefoot and dressed as a penitent, begging forgiveness. The ritual was likely arranged in advance and symbolized the restoration of imperial favor. Although pardoned, he suffered material losses and was required to surrender lands to another bishopric. This event illustrates the importance of ceremonial gestures in resolving political conflicts and restoring hierarchical order. More serious and lasting tensions emerged in the final years of Conrad's reign, particularly in Italy and Burgundy. Several prominent bishops resisted imperial authority, seeking to defend their secular privileges and political independence. These disputes centered on power rather than theology, and neither side proved willing to compromise. The emperor treated these church leaders much as he would secular opponents, deposing and exiling them without formal ecclesiastical trials. Such actions provoked criticism because bishops, as consecrated religious figures, were believed to possess a sacred status that demanded special legal treatment. The harsh measures taken against these leaders caused unrest even within the imperial court. Members of the ruling family and clergy questioned the emperor's decisions, and later, rulers attempted to reverse many of these actions. In some cases, church offices were left vacant after their leaders were removed, while in one important city, the emperor installed a rival archbishop to replace the deposed incumbent. These policies demonstrated the limits of royal authority in religious matters and revealed the tensions created when political control clashed with ecclesiastical tradition. Alongside his dealings with bishops, Conrad also shaped the religious landscape through his policies toward monasteries. Imperial monasteries held a special status because their freedom and privileges depended directly on the ruler's protection. Earlier, rulers had taken a strong personal interest in monastic reform, promoting strict discipline and overseeing internal organization. Conrad generally continued existing policies, but showed less personal enthusiasm for monastic life. He confirmed earlier grants of property, transferred some monasteries to episcopal control, and occasionally granted religious institutions to secular nobles for political reasons. At times, he showed little concern for monastic independence, treating religious foundations as instruments of political reward. Yet, he did not attempt to absorb privately owned monasteries into royal control or impose sweeping reforms across the monastic world. His involvement was selective and pragmatic, shaped more by political needs than by religious conviction. One important religious foundation created during his reign was established from an ancestral fortress and later transformed into a monastery. Although intended to serve as a significant spiritual center, the project achieved only limited success. The emperor entrusted its development to a respected reforming abbot, hoping to promote disciplined religious life. But the institution never fully flourished and eventually declined. Conrad maintained a close relationship with a prominent reforming abbot, whose influence extended across many monasteries. This church leader played an important role in diplomacy between rival kingdoms and helped secure political alliances. He also directed the reform of several monastic communities, introducing stricter observance of religious rules and reorganizing leadership structures. Through him, the emperor exercised indirect influence over monastic life, though this influence was neither systematic nor universal. Monastic reform during this period often produced resistance. When new abbots attempted to impose stricter discipline or alter established customs, monks sometimes opposed the changes. Imperial intervention could remove existing leaders and install new ones, but such measures rarely produced lasting harmony. Conflicts between different reform movements also shaped monastic life, as competing interpretations of religious discipline struggled for dominance. One famous monastery experienced a dramatic transformation when its abbot was removed and replaced with a reform-minded successor. The emperor's involvement in this change remains debated, but the new leadership introduced stricter observance and restored order. Similar interventions occurred elsewhere, demonstrating that royal authority could reshape religious institutions when political or moral concerns demanded action. In southern Germany, several monasteries experienced cycles of decline and renewal. Some had fallen into disorder after the collapse of earlier dynasties and required reorganization. Reforming abbots introduced new educational programs, strengthened discipline, and expanded property holdings. Monastery schools flourished, producing literary works and contributing to intellectual life. At times, these reforms created tension between traditional monastic practices and new approaches to education, especially concerning the use of classical learning versus strictly religious instruction. The emperor's involvement in these developments was often indirect. Local bishops, royal guardians, or monastic leaders carried out reforms, while the ruler confirmed their actions or granted privileges. Some abbots were removed for political reasons rather than religious failings, and local rivalries frequently shaped outcomes. In many cases, imperial authority functioned as a distant force that could legitimize decisions, but did not always control events. Other monasteries required even more dramatic intervention. Some had fallen into severe moral and economic decline, and their recovery required new leadership and external support. Reforming abbots reorganized finances, rebuilt churches, and restored religious discipline. In certain cases, monks publicly appealed to the emperor for assistance, emphasizing their poverty and seeking protection. These appeals often resulted in renewed privileges and financial aid, allowing the institutions to recover. The emperor also supported the reform of major monastic centres across the empire. Some monasteries adopted stricter daily routines and emphasised obedience and ascetic discipline. Their churches were rebuilt according to consistent architectural plans and decorated with elaborate artistic programmes, reflecting both spiritual renewal and growing wealth. Although not all reforms succeeded, they contributed to a broader transformation of religious life. Despite these efforts, not every foundation prospered. Some newly established monasteries quickly declined because of internal disputes or ineffective leadership. Even institutions founded by the emperor himself sometimes failed to achieve lasting significance. These failures reveal the limits of royal influence over religious life and the complexity of monastic reform. Throughout Conrad's reign, the relationship between political authority and religious institutions remained complex and constantly evolving. Bishops and abbots served as administrators, diplomats, and military supporters, as well as spiritual leaders. The emperor relied on their loyalty, but also sought to control their power. Cooperation and conflict existed side by side, shaped by personal relationships, political necessity, and religious ideals. Conrad II has often been described as a ruler deeply involved in simony, the practice of buying and selling church offices. Yet the historical evidence behind this accusation is far less certain than it may first appear. Claims that he knowingly exchanged ecclesiastical positions for money do not withstand close scrutiny. Later, reformers at the papal court praised his son, Henry III, for opposing simony, which indirectly contributed to the image of Conrad as guilty of the practice. Writers such as Peter Damian even suggested that rulers defended such exchanges as a necessary tool of government, comparing them to oil that keeps the machinery of the state running smoothly. Over time, this portrayal of Conrad hardened into a lasting reputation, shaped by medieval chroniclers and later historians alike. Yet a careful reading of the sources reveals that many of these accusations reflect the values and conflicts of later generations more than the realities of Conrad's own rule. One of the main accounts describing widespread corruption in the church comes from a monk who wrote about Henry III's efforts to condemn simony across Europe. According to this account, church officials at every level were accused of greed, and even Conrad himself was said to have been driven by a lifelong attachment to wealth. However, such reports focus primarily on the general climate of the 11th century, rather than providing clear evidence about Conrad's specific policies. Other criticisms, including claims that he sold bishoprics for large sums of money, were written years after his reign and reflect later moral standards, rather than contemporary practice. A well-known episode concerns the appointment of a bishop in Basel shortly after Conrad secured control of the city. The new bishop reportedly paid a substantial amount of money, which was later interpreted as proof of simony. Yet the transaction may have represented a form of political obligation or financial contribution associated with royal service, rather than a corrupt exchange. The appointment also involved several powerful church leaders and political figures, indicating that multiple parties benefited from the arrangement. The event appears less like a simple case of bribery and more like a complex negotiation shaped by political and economic interests. Other accusations against Conrad are even less convincing. Some later writers suggested that church service at court could lead to profitable appointments, while others described administrative decisions concerning monasteries as corrupt. In one case, a troubled monastery was placed under the authority of a bishop after internal disorder and financial mismanagement threatened its stability. While the transfer may have benefited the imperial treasury, it also strengthened strategic control over an important region. Such actions reflect practical governance rather than clear evidence of simony. several stories of corruption originate in sources written generations after Conrad's death. These accounts often emerged during periods of intense conflict between secular rulers and church reformers, particularly during the investiture controversy. They reveal more about the political tensions of later centuries than about the policies of Conrad himself. When all surviving references are examined together, the evidence for systematic simony during his reign proves remarkably limited. Church councils held under Conrad's authority further complicate the picture. At a major assembly in 1036, church leaders focus not on punishing high-ranking officials, but on regulating everyday religious practices. Priests were forbidden from charging fees for baptisms or burials, and church authorities were prohibited from selling sacred objects or offices. These measures targeted common abuses within local communities, rather than accusing the emperor or senior clergy of corruption. The decisions suggest a concern with practical discipline rather than sweeping reform. Conrad's involvement in church councils was generally limited. He attended relatively few synods and rarely took an active role in their proceedings. Compared with his predecessor, who presided over many more such gatherings, Conrad treated these assemblies primarily as tools for resolving technical disputes that threatened public order. Issues brought before these councils included conflicts over church jurisdiction, disputes about marriage within prohibited degrees of kinship, rival claims to ecclesiastical authority, and disagreements about religious observances. One of the most prominent disputes concerned control over a religious foundation whose jurisdiction had long been contested by different church authorities. Early in his reign, Conrad participated actively in a council addressing the matter, although the proceedings remained largely under episcopal supervision. In other cases, he appeared mainly as an honorary figure while church leaders conducted the discussions. His involvement increased only when disputes threatened political stability or public harmony. At times, the emperor intervened directly when conflict escalated. During one council, a leading church official publicly rebuked a powerful abbess, provoking a confrontation that required imperial mediation. On another occasion, Conrad allowed church authorities to deliberate freely, but ensured that the final decision reflected the consensus of all participants. His actions reveal a cautious approach in that balanced royal authority with ecclesiastical autonomy. A major council held later in his reign dealt with a wide range of disciplinary matters, including financial practices within the church and questions of marriage law. Although the emperor formally presided over the gathering, church leaders directed most of the proceedings. Among the decisions reached was the abolition of a special tax imposed on certain subject populations, demonstrating that political and economic concerns were closely linked to religious administration. When the outcome of a council appeared predictable, Conrad sometimes chose not to attend at all. His absence from one important assembly illustrates his pragmatic attitude toward the papacy, which he regarded less as an independent authority than as an institution expected to carry out its assigned functions. Nevertheless, he acted decisively when religious disputes threatened to disrupt social order, intervening swiftly to resolve conflicts over ritual practice and public observance. Overall, Conrad's approach to church affairs reveals no grand ideological program. His decisions were shaped by immediate political considerations and practical concerns, rather than by a comprehensive vision of religious reform. Personal relationships often influenced appointments to church offices, and members of the royal household or family frequently received preference. Like many rulers of his time, he expected religious communities to maintain discipline and moral conduct, yet his support for reform movements remained inconsistent. The religious landscape of the period itself was deeply divided. Various groups promoted different forms of monastic life, each claiming to restore authentic tradition. No unified program of reform existed, and even leading church figures disagreed about the proper direction of religious practice. Under such conditions, imperial policy could only respond to individual situations, rather than follow a coherent strategy. Conrad's partnership with his wife played a significant role in ecclesiastical matters. She frequently influenced decisions and recommended candidates for important positions, though her actions generally aligned with the emperor's broader goals. Their cooperation reflected the collaborative nature of medieval rulership, rather than a division of governmental responsibilities resembling modern institutions. Despite criticism from later reformers, Conrad's relationship with the church must be understood within the context of his time. The sweeping religious reforms that transformed the later 11th century had not yet emerged, and early advocates of reform sought mainly to restore established practices rather than introduce new ideas. Religious communities struggled with internal disputes, uncertain traditions, and competing interpretations of authority. In this environment, even well-intentioned rulers faced limited options. The emperor's personality also shaped his policies. Medieval writers often portrayed him as practical, confident, and grounded in noble traditions. His decisions reflected a belief in the continuity of royal authority beyond the individual ruler and in the enduring nature of the political order. At the same time, he relied heavily on personal relationships, negotiation, and compromise. His speeches and reported sayings, though often recorded in polished literary form, present a ruler concerned with stability and order. He emphasized the permanence of the state and the necessity of maintaining authority even in times of crisis. While some of these speeches were likely shaped by later writers, they capture the image of a leader who combined personal power with an awareness of broader political structures. Contrary to later accusations of harshness, Conrad rarely acted without consultation. He sought advice from trusted counselors, delegated responsibilities to family members, and negotiated extensively with rivals. Conflicts with rebellious nobles or church leaders often involved prolonged attempts at reconciliation before decisive action was taken. His approach reflected the political realities of a society built on personal loyalty and negotiated authority. Modern observers sometimes criticize him for lacking a grand strategic vision, yet his policies reveal consistent goals. He aimed to strengthen royal authority, maintain public peace, and expand imperial influence where possible. His reign witnessed significant administrative innovations, including changes in legal procedures and diplomatic practices that shaped later imperial governance. Law and politics were closely intertwined in his rule. Judicial proceedings served not only to resolve disputes, but also to reinforce authority and maintain stability. Courts convened under royal supervision settled conflicts between nobles, church institutions, and local communities. These proceedings often confirmed negotiated settlements rather than imposing arbitrary judgments, reflecting a political culture that valued public agreement. In territorial administration, Conrad demonstrated flexibility. He confirmed local legal traditions where necessary, adapted Roman law in certain regions, and supported economic development by granting privileges to merchants. His policies encouraged trade, protected commercial activity, and recognized the growing importance of urban economic life. As emperor, Conrad governed multiple kingdoms and sought to enhance their unity under imperial authority. He expanded influence in Burgundy and Italy while maintaining stability in Germany. His military campaigns primarily aimed to defend and consolidate existing territories, rather than pursue aggressive expansion. His imperial ideology emphasized the continuity of Roman authority and the enduring significance of Rome as the center of political order. Although he visited the city only briefly, its symbolic importance shaped his understanding of empire. His reign marked a shift toward a more pragmatic style of rule that balanced traditional ideals with practical governance. During Conrad's second expedition to Italy, death cut deeply into the ranks of the German elite, yet the losses did not end there. In the years 1038 and early 1039, the northern regions of the empire also witnessed a wave of deaths among leading nobles. Even before Duke Hermann IV of Swabia, son of Empress Gisela from her second marriage, fell ill and died in Italy in July 1038, Count Ludolf of Brunswick, Gisela's son from her first marriage, had already passed away. The imperial family was struck repeatedly by grief, and the court endured a period marked by loss and uncertainty. Despite these personal tragedies, political developments during the final months of 1038 seemed to favour the emperor's plans. Conrad declared his son Henry as heir to the Duchy of Swabia, a decision that received limited attention at the time, but strengthened the position of the young ruler within the empire. Soon afterward, at a formal ceremony held in the Burgundian region, Conrad granted Henry authority over the Kingdom of Burgundy, at least in name. This act was far more widely noted, as it symbolized the expansion and consolidation of imperial power across multiple territories. The emperor then resumed his constant movement through the lands under his rule. From Burgundy, he traveled to Basel, a city he frequently visited, where the imperial entourage likely embarked on ships to continue their journey along the Rhine. When Conrad and Henry arrived in Strasbourg, toward the end of November 1038, the local bishop attempted to honour the emperor by linking his arrival with the beginning of the Advent season. The proposal, however, provoked controversy. After consulting his advisers, Conrad rejected the suggestion and soon departed. By the following week, he had reached Limburg, where he participated in the traditional observance marking the first Sunday of Advent. Taking advantage of the large gathering of bishops present at the celebration, he ensured that the established date for the start of the Christmas season was reaffirmed, emphasizing the importance of maintaining religious tradition. Empress Gisela had not accompanied Conrad and Henry during their visits to Burgundy and the Rhineland, but she rejoined the court at Limburg. Shortly afterward, the imperial family and their retinue moved again along the Rhine, reaching a royal residence near Mainz in December. There, they received news of the death of a wealthy noblewoman whose extensive lands offered new political opportunities. The prospect of securing her estates for the imperial household prompted decisive action. The emperor granted privileges to a powerful archbishop whose support was essential, and the empress was soon permitted to travel north to oversee the matter personally. Her departure so soon after reuniting with the emperor may seem surprising, yet Conrad had pressing responsibilities elsewhere. Evidence suggests that he continued his journey across eastern regions of the empire, working to preserve order and enforce legal authority. His travels during the winter months demonstrate a ruler still actively engaged in governance, determined to secure stability across his territories. By early 1039, Conrad's health had begun to decline. He spent several months confined to his favorite palace, apparently unable to travel because of illness. Earlier, toward the end of 1038, he had hastened to the royal residence at Goslar, perhaps seeking the comfort of a well-equipped palace as his condition worsened. There, he celebrated Christmas with his family and court. During the festivities, a strange and unsettling natural phenomenon appeared in the sky, interpreted by many as an ominous sign. Yet no immediate change in policy or behaviour followed this event. The emperor continued his routine, moving between royal residences and attending to affairs of state. After remaining for a time in Saxony, Conrad travelled to another palace for the celebration of Candlemas in early 1039. By the end of winter, he had reached Nijmegen, where he remained for several months. During this period, he continued to handle political matters, including disputes within religious institutions and the issuance of final administrative orders. Although weakened, he was still capable of carrying out the responsibilities of rule. By early summer, his condition appeared to improve slightly, allowing him to travel once more. He journeyed to Utrecht, where he celebrated the Feast of Pentecost, surrounded by his family and court. During the celebrations, he participated in religious ceremonies and public festivities, maintaining the appearance of strength. Yet during a banquet, he was suddenly overcome by severe pain. Determined not to disturb the gathering, he concealed his suffering and continued the feast. The following day, the attacks returned with greater intensity. Unable to endure the pain, he dismissed those around him and prepared himself for death. Clergy were summoned to administer the final rites. After confessing and receiving communion, Conrad was presented with sacred relics believed to offer protection in his final hours. His wife and son were then called to his side. After speaking to them and offering his final instructions, the emperor died around midday in early June 1039. His death came unexpectedly, and its precise cause remains uncertain. Contemporary observers attributed it to gout, a painful condition that afflicted him in his later years. While such attacks rarely prove fatal, the emperor's body had endured decades of physical strain from constant travel, military campaigns, and political responsibilities. The cumulative effects of illness, age, and exhaustion may have left him unable to recover from the final episode. Following his death, preparations for burial began. His internal organs were interred at the place of his passing, while his body was carefully preserved and prepared for transport. Wrapped in rich fabrics and placed in a coffin, his remains were carried by boat along the Rhine toward the city, chosen as his final resting place. The funeral procession moved slowly, stopping at major cities along the river. In each location, churches opened their doors to receive the body, and crowds gathered to pray and mourn. The journey lasted many days, marked by solemn ceremonies and public displays of grief. Upon reaching the cathedral at Speyer, the emperor's body was placed in the tomb reserved for the founders of the church. His son, now ruler in his own right, played a central role in the funeral rites. At every church entrance, he personally lifted the coffin upon his shoulder before entering, a gesture that expressed both filial devotion and the symbolic duty of a vassal toward his sovereign. The burial ceremony itself was elaborate, reflecting the prestige of the deceased ruler. A simple crown was placed upon his head, and an inscription honored him as a bringer of peace and a benefactor of Rome. Empress Gisela survived her husband by several years. She died in the royal palace at Goslar and was laid to rest beside him in the cathedral at Speyer. Her own burial crown bore a modest inscription naming her as Empress, a striking contrast to the grand titles and achievements associated with her husband. Though political tensions had marked her later relationship with her son, her burial reflected the personal bonds that had defined her life within the imperial family. Contemporary writers described Conrad's death as a moment of profound loss for the empire. Many accounts emphasize the widespread mourning that followed, portraying a ruler favored by divine grace and deeply respected by his subjects. His passing was linked with other recent deaths among the aristocracy, creating a sense that an entire generation of leaders had vanished in a short span of time. Yet reactions were not universally sorrowful. Some regions expressed only limited grief, and certain observers viewed his death with indifference. Such responses reveal the complexity of his legacy. To supporters, he had been a powerful and stabilizing ruler, whose authority extended across vast territories. To critics, he remained a distant figure whose policies had not always earned their loyalty. With Conrad's death, a long and demanding reign came to an end. His life had been shaped by constant movement, political negotiation, and the pursuit of imperial authority across multiple kingdoms. The ceremonies that followed his passing reflected both the grandeur of his office and the tensions that had defined his rule. His legacy endured in the strengthened position of the empire and in the structures of power he had helped to shape, even as the memory of his reign remained subject to differing interpretations among those who had lived under his authority.